feeling upbeat, you can hit us up and let us know on our COVID hotline, 202-382-7664. 202-382-7664 is one of the ways that we can get through this pandemic together.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Alice Bryant, and Anna Mateo. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Pete Musto.
Many colleges and universities in the United States are in small towns around America. When the coronavirus struck in March, students went home, leaving the towns empty. So, what will happen to those communities in the near future? The New York town of Ithaca is about to find out. In Ithaca, most of the 24,000 students at Cornell University and 6,200 from Ithaca College have left. Now, locals who run businesses that depend on students' money are wondering if things will ever return to normal. It's going to be hard. I mean, normally we have about 7 months that the colleges are here, said Gregor Brouse. He runs several restaurants in Ithaca. He has brought about 100 of his usual 330 employees back to work. Brouse added that one of the biggest problems for small businesses is that there are so many unknowns. Ithaca College says its students will return to the school in the autumn. But they will do so in October, several weeks later than usual. Cornell, one of America's so-called Ivy League schools, says it plans to bring students back this fall. But they also will arrive weeks later than usual. Many people expect that even if students do return, they will mostly stay on campus and not go out to restaurants and bars. Locals also worry that returning students will bring COVID-19 into their community. Ithaca Mayor Savante Myrick said it is possible international travel restrictions could affect Cornell, since almost 25% of the university's students are from other countries. If people don't feel comfortable sending their children across the country or across the world back to our campuses, then we'll start to shed jobs, Myrick said. Cornell students spend an estimated $225 million each year in Ithaca. There are many stores and restaurants on the Ithaca Commons, a shopping area near the campus. Before coronavirus, it was so easy to get a job. You couldn't avoid it. They were everywhere, said Matt Stupak. He was a cook, but lost his job when restaurants closed. Ithaca is still doing well compared to other places in the U.S. The area's April unemployment rate increased to 10%, but that is lower than other parts of New York. Cornell University is the area's largest employer, with 10,000 workers. So far, it has not had any job cuts. The university also gave $100,000 to help local businesses. But in many college towns, the local economy collapsed when the students went home. Our entire economy left, said Gabrielle Gould. She is executive director of the Amherst Business Improvement District. Amherst, a college town in Massachusetts, had to deal with the sudden loss of 35,000 students from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and four other colleges in the area. By May, Amherst had a 32.6% unemployment rate, a study by the Pioneer Institute in Massachusetts found. Even if schools permit students to come back in the fall, no one knows how many will actually choose to return. Some students and their parents may not want to pay the high cost of tuition for a less social college experience. How worried am I for Ithaca if the future of higher education changes? Myrick said. I am worried. I am extremely worried. I'm Pete Musto.
Kramer used to wear a lot of turquoise jewelry on both hands. When Kramer moved to New York City in the 1970s, a fortune teller told him he must always wear something turquoise to look after his health. He trusted that claim. In the years that followed, Kramer survived the liver disease, hepatitis B, and had a liver transplant operation. He had also battled HIV for more than 30 years. HIV is the name of the virus that causes the disease AIDS. Kramer, a playwright and AIDS activist for many years, once said, God knows how he survived all those health problems. He spoke with VOA before dying of pneumonia last month. He was 84 years old. A series of antiviral drugs kept Kramer and millions of others with HIV alive for many years. The first of those drugs was studied and received U.S. government approval in the 1990s. But before that success, the search for an effective treatment took more than 10 years and caused fierce clashes between Americans and the government. Kramer launched AIDS activism in the United States. He demanded money for research and treatments for a mysterious disease that researchers identified in 1981. They would later link AIDS to the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, which most often is passed sexually. Infected people accused the government of not taking steps to fight a disease that was mostly killing gay men. Ronald Reagan, who was president, never even said the word AIDS until his second term in office, Kramer said. By the end of 1986, more than 16,000 Americans with AIDS had died. In 1987, Kramer started ACT UP, the first group to put together loud, energetic protests over an epidemic which had no effective treatments. A protest on October 11, 1988, would become ACT UP's most memorable clash with the U.S. government. The group forced the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, to close its headquarters near Washington, D.C. That day, ACT UP blocked roads to the FDA offices. Protesters lay on the ground in front of the building with homemade tombstones. They also hung a sign above the entrance to the building with ACT UP's saying, "Silence equals death." Richard Klein was the FDA's representative to the AIDS community at the time. He called ACT UP's protest a great wake-up call for the FDA. Speaking with VOA, Klein recalled the uneasy days between the AIDS activists and federal officials. And he noted that changes did come. Activists were added to FDA advisory committees as patient representatives. The agency expanded patient access to experimental drug studies. Many of those studies were sped up and extended. Trial patients whose health was failing were moved to groups getting the drug or drugs being tested. It took people who were dying to really make the point of, "We don't want to die in these clinical trials," Klein said. Yet AIDS patients continued to die, 300,000 in the United States by 1995. The most widely used drug at the time, AZT, was developed in the 1960s and approved as an AIDS treatment in 1987. AZT did slow the weakening of patients' natural defenses for fighting disease. However, the HIV virus became resistant to the medication, and the deadly path of AIDS continued. In June of 1995, the FDA approved a study of sequinavir, the first of a new group of drugs called protease inhibitors. They were designed to prevent the HIV virus from reproducing. These drugs were thought to be a way to end virus resistance issues, Klein explained. Sequinavir proved ineffective by itself. But when combined with AZT and other antiviral medication, it led to an increase in white blood cell counts in AIDS patients. That was a clear sign that the body's disease-fighting systems had begun to recover. Most importantly, the HIV virus did not develop resistance to the combined drugs. Fewer than 4 months after getting the results, the FDA gave the fastest drug approval ever to sequinavir as part of a combination treatment for HIV/AIDS. I'm Alice Bryant.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Relationships between people can be complex. So to help, there are some good rules to follow. For example, when dealing with people at work or with a friend, it is usually a good idea to stay calm and be easygoing. Personal or working relationships can be damaged if you shout at other people or get angry with someone. This is especially true if that certain someone helps you in a meaningful way, like making sure you get paid. To describe that situation, the English language has a very useful expression: to bite the hand that feeds you. This phrase means that you act badly toward the person who is helping or has helped you. When you bite the hand that feeds you, you are being unthankful, ungrateful, unappreciative. And that is a lot of unwords. In other words, you turn against, attack, and even harm someone who is helping you. We often use this expression as a word of advice, as in, don't bite, or you should not bite the hand that feeds you. Now, let's use it in an example. Let's say someone comes to your place of business and wants to buy something from you, or even offer you a chance at a new job. But you, in return, are rude to that person. In that case, I could say to you, you should not bite the hand that feeds you. This expression can also mean to turn against someone who helped you in the past. Used this way, you do not show respect for someone who has been there for you. Some people say this phrase goes all the way back to ancient Greece. The poet Sappho was said to have used it over 2,600 years ago. Other experts claim that one of Aesop's fables, called The Gardener and His Dog, shows an example of this expression. The story goes something like this. A gardener's dog was playing in the garden near a well, and then fell in. The owner ran to help. He reached his hand into the well to pull out his dog. But as the man did this, the dog bit him on the hand. "What very ungrateful behavior. I only came to help," said the gardener. So he left the dog and walked away. The dog bit the hand that fed him, and that was a big mistake. Here is another example. Let's say I am working as an interior designer. I go into people's homes and decide how to improve them. I choose everything from wall paint and floorings to artwork, tables, and chairs. Now, because I own my own business, my clients are very important to me. They are my bread and butter, meaning my earnings are based on the money they pay me. If my clients are happy with my work, they will tell other people, and that word-of-mouth business means more work and more money for me. But there is a problem. I have a difficult client. He is always changing his mind about design decisions and does not communicate well. So small issues often become big problems. What should I do? On one hand, I could tell him to find another interior designer. On the other hand, I could just find a way to work with him. If the economy is weak, it may not be a good idea to lose a client, even a difficult one. I decide to not bite the hand that feeds me and put up with the difficult client. If the economy improves, then I can show him the door. And that's our show for today. Try using this expression. Have you ever bitten the hand that fed you? Or perhaps someone bit your hand? Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Martin Van Buren. He was sworn in as the 8th President of the United States in 1837. Van Buren had already been working for the White House for several years. He had been the Secretary of State for President Andrew Jackson, and later his vice president. Jackson asked his party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. They agreed, and Van Buren won that election easily. But he did not win the next election, or the next, or the next. In his inaugural speech in 1837, Van Buren noted that he was the first U.S. president to be born after the American Revolution. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His ancestors were Dutch. He remains the only president, so far, who did not speak English as his first language. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren predicted better times for Americans. But several days later, an economic crisis struck. The situation put the country in a depression that lasted for the rest of Van Buren's term. It was one reason the president's opponents called him Martin Van Ruin. The depression was not Van Buren's only problem. He also faced a dispute with Britain related to the border between the U.S. and Canada. The conflict nearly turned into war. Historian Joel Silby says most experts do not think Van Buren was a strong president. However, Silby notes, Van Buren left an important legacy that still operates today. He created the modern U.S. political system. Van Buren's political education began early. His father was a farmer and operated a hotel at a small town in New York State. Lawmakers sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended farmers who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official, and then a senator, and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with, but she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with four sons. Historian Joel Silby says, although Van Buren did not remarry, he was known as quite charming among the ladies. Van Buren had a gift for politics, that is, developing relationships and forming alliances. Historian Joel Silby says most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his work-related life and social activities separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. His ability to make friends became a powerful tool. Before Van Buren, even lawmakers from the same political party operated independently. They had their own beliefs, their own supporters, and their own allies. Van Buren brought them together. First, he identified people who followed the ideas of Thomas Jefferson, support for independent farmers and states' rights. The group had become known as the Democratic Party, although it was in many ways different from the Democratic Party of today. Van Buren organized meetings for Democrats to talk about their political beliefs. he persuaded them to support the same policies, at that time, the policies of Andrew Jackson. Sometimes, Van Buren helped people who supported Jackson's policies. He gave them government jobs. Van Buren also used a series of meetings to choose one presidential candidate for the party. If this process seems clear-cut, it was not at the time. During the election of 1824, for example, a single party had four separate candidates for president, one for each part of the country. Van Buren's system eventually gave rise to the national conventions that major U.S. parties use today to nominate their candidates. Van Buren also helped create the modern political campaign. In the 1820s, he saw that many state constitutions were lifting some of their voting restrictions. As a result, states were giving more white males the right to vote. Women, and most African American men, were still largely prohibited from voting. Historian Joel Silby says, Van Buren wanted to bring the new voters into the Democratic Party. He decided to improve on the methods that other, smaller groups had used. Campaign events, speeches, and organized efforts to bring people to vote on Election Day. Silby explains that these efforts to persuade and energize voters were new to national politics. Now they are some of the major features of political campaigns. In the election of 1840, Van Buren sought a second term as president. This time, his opponents used Van Buren's political techniques against him. Silby says the new opposition party, called the Whigs, used popular speeches and events to portray Van Buren as a failed president. Crowds shouted, "Matty Van is a used-up man." In other words, he no longer had any power or effect in government. Critics also made fun of Van Buren's fine-looking, even fussy clothes. They portrayed him as a rich, elite candidate. They compared him unfavorably to their candidate, a military hero named William Henry Harrison. Yet it was Van Buren who had come from a poor family, and Harrison from a wealthy one. Even so, Van Buren lost the election of 1840. 4 years later, Van Buren again sought the presidency. This time, even Andrew Jackson did not support him. Instead, Jackson backed a man who supported the seizure of Texas and expanding slavery, James Polk. But Van Buren did not permit those defeats to stop his political career. He ran again in the presidential election of 1848. This time, Van Buren withdrew from the Democratic Party he had helped build. He ran instead as the candidate of a new anti-slavery party called the Free Soilers. But even Van Buren's political skills could not persuade voters. He did not win a single state. After losing this final presidential election, Van Buren finally retired. He spent time with his children and grandchildren, traveled, and wrote about his life. At 79, he died of heart failure. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.